Ken and I always joke we may be the last two folks with R&D in our names to actually work together, but he and I do a speaking series across the country in addition to working together overseas. We do it with the World Affairs Council to try and explain exactly what we mean by democracy building. And when we walk into the room, I think the common impression is the following: that democracy building began in the Bush administration in Iraq and Afghanistan, that it is pursued at bayonet point to help the natives accept our exported American version of democracy through elections overnight. Ken has done a good job, I think, of going through the first issue that I mentioned, that democracy building began with President Bush. Its roots actually go back many decades, as we all know. And over the last 30 years, for a variety of reasons, more than 80 nations have become democratic, tripling the number of democracies on Earth. When this effort began under Presidents Carter and Reagan, many warned that it would not be effective for a number of reasons. And Ken mentioned that we were all told by Latin experts that the Caudillo system and the hierarchy of the Catholic Church would prevent democracy from having a future in Latin America. I was pleased last night to listen to the new Secretary General of the OAS, who was himself a dissident and went into exile from Chile, talk about the importance of democracy in Latin America. My education is in Asia, China in specific, and I was told 20 years ago by those who were older and wiser than me that the communal way of life in the region meant that the competition involved in democracy was alien to Asia and could never occur. Since democracy came to Mongolia, South Korea, Taiwan, Indonesia, and elsewhere, we hear less about the Asian way. 15 years ago, as Ken mentioned, we were told tribalism meant that democracy could only bring disaster to Africa. And since democracy has come to Benin, Botswana, Burkina Faso, and a dozen other countries in Africa, we don't hear it that much. You will remember even 10 years ago, experts in the Balkans and others like Robert Kaplan in Balkan Ghosts said that Slavic history and culture doomed democracy in the region. The argument that democracy is alien to all of these cultures has faltered as democracy has come to diverse nations from Mongolia to Mali to Mexico. Another argument from the skeptics involves what I call the 50-year plan: get an economy, get a middle class, get democracy. This is a theory that, in fact, was widespread in the 50s, and in theory, it does make sense. We can all think of a few Asian nations where that has occurred. But try to think of some more outside of Asia, and I think you'll come up close to empty. There are many more nations where democracy and free markets have developed hand in hand, and quite a few where democracy preceded free markets. I mentioned over the last 30 years that more than 80 nations have become democratic. You think of how many we have invaded, six. It clearly becomes apparent that democracy is being aided by something other than bayonets. One can hardly watch the recent protests in Burma and not believe that people everywhere, even in a tiny Asian country like Burma, want to be free of tyranny. And if you ask the people in Burma or the 74 recently democratized nations that we didn't invade, they will rightly take the lion's share of the credit for changing their countries, and they are absolutely correct. But they will also tell you that they were assisted in part by the outside, by the United States, by Britain, by Germany, and that this played a small role, a marginal role, in their eventual victory. Part of the reason they are interested in our assistance is the spirit in which it is offered. We who do this for a living know that the quickest way to get shot or thrown out of a country is to put our arm around someone and say, "Little brother, I'm from America, and I'm here to help." We know that our role is to walk two steps behind, to give advice when asked, and to present as many democratic development examples as possible. We are aided increasingly in this effort by trainers and others from places like Chile and Serbia and Kenya and Indonesia, men and women who we once assisted and who, in a way that testifies to the effectiveness of thoughtful democracy support, now offer their country's experiences to others. Fareed Zakaria and others have raised, about 8 years ago, something that those of us who do this work recognized about 15 years ago, Elections do not equal democracy. Elections are a prerequisite but an insufficient condition for democracy. So 95% of the work of IRI and NDI and others occurs in between elections, helping to build the capacity and reach of issues-based political parties, helping civil society groups form, and helping women and minorities enter the political process. And even though we are American, Ken and I have patience. Our democracy is still not perfected, even after more than two centuries. We know that much of our work will ultimately pay off in 5 or 10 or 20 or even 30 years, and those are the time horizons that we need to have. All of this was part of the background many of us brought to the table in the weeks after 9/11. The question after 9/11 was whether the human rights and democracy policies, bipartisan, that went back to Jimmy Carter and President Reagan should be shelved, or whether they should be extended to the Arab world. Some of us had worked in Arab countries doing exactly this work before it was cool in the 1990s, helping Oman's Majlis Ashura develop, helping Morocco's parliament and local governments, assisting Yemen's political parties, and aiding Palestinian pollsters and political figures. We were looking in the days of talk of draining the swamp, do we all remember that phrase, of methods between invading and doing nothing. Our experience of successfully offering many models of democracy in various regions overseas, including the Middle East, informed the debate. Now, it is certainly the case that Arab rulers and their inner circles have taken offense at President Bush's talk of democracy and freedom. And I can't tell you I'm shocked. Given how they've ruled all these years, it would be surprising if they were open to change. And these rulers echo many of the same complaints we heard from Pinochet, Marcos, Fujimori, P.W. Botha, and others. Just as those dictators told us it was a choice between them and the communists, today the authoritarians in their area and many area experts tell us that the choice is between Mubarak or the Saudi royal family and Islamic extremists. Given the rulers' repression of any secular or moderate options, they will continue to be able to make that case. That argument has certainly gained currency from the victories of Hamas and the Muslim Brotherhood, but I think we'd all do well to look at the reasons behind those victories, which Ken mentioned. Hamas's victory, for example, was about corruption, service delivery, and electoral skill. It was not about their ideology. We do hear many rulers in the region complaining, but I don't hear the people in Arab countries complaining that we're talking about freedom and democracy. What I do hear is a lot of people in the Middle East complaining that of late we're not talking enough about these issues. So in terms of lessons learned, I think you'd be shocked if I said we should end this effort. I won't say that, nor will I say we should do more of it or even continue precisely as we have been. Clearly, we need to modulate the policy to suit the circumstances. Let me offer the following thoughts. First, there are some good and important parts to our policy. Long before 9/11, some rulers in the area, in Oman, in Morocco, and even a little bit in Qatar before 9/11, recognized that their political systems needed to be modernized. At the time, in the 1990s, this trend was noted, but hardly encouraged by the United States. Those rulers are on to something, and it's something we should continue to encourage diplomatically throughout the region. Second, in many other countries and other regions, the U.S. maintained relations with a ruler while helping to open up their system. The U.S. at the time, if you recall, faced charges of hypocrisy for doing so. But ultimately, those efforts paid off in gradual democratic change. We should not be driven to either-or choices in the Arab world. NGOs like IRI and NDI can be part of this policy, and Ken often talks about high diplomacy and low diplomacy, high diplomacy relations between states, low diplomacy, the efforts of groups like ours. We can continue to offer the technical assistance that I've mentioned, but our work is immeasurably less effective without support from the United States government. I'm not necessarily talking about money, which I'll get to in a moment, but diplomatic support from our embassies and support from our president and our secretary of state. It all makes the slow, deliberate assistance that is our specialty much more effective. And if it is part of the equation that governs relations with Washington, it helps inform Arab government decisions about whether to allow more democratic openings. It is certainly the case that we have been spooked, rightly, by some of the election results coming out of the region. It would have been difficult in pushing for more freedom to ignore scheduled elections in the region that are neither free or fair. But as I mentioned earlier, the work we do is not necessarily just about elections, but what happens in between elections. Finally, on the diplomatic side, support for dissidents, what we once offered to the Lech Wałęsas and Václav Havels and Nelson Mandelas and Kim Dae-jungs, also encourages constructive regime credits to critics to participate in an evolving political milieu instead of going to exile or being jailed or in some cases being killed. Change will come to the Middle East just as it did in Poland and the Czech Republic and South Africa and South Korea, even though we were told it never would. And we can either get some credit when it happens, as we did in those countries, or we can let it go forward without any assistance or sympathy or help from us, as it did in Iran. I think one can have a good discussion about the volume of our diplomacy on the issue. This is one of the things I will talk about that should change. Many loud public statements on this issue, of course, raised expectations. And if the U.S. government is going to raise expectations, we should be prepared to meet them. If we're going to pursue a more long-term policy on democratic change in the region, we should be prepared to use more behind-the-scenes talk. A complaint I have made about the administration's policy, and Scott talked about this too, is that the high volume of public talk on this issue has not been supported by changes to the internal administration architecture designed to support democracy. The U.S. government needs to have its name on some of the aid going to the region. And I found this when I was Assistant Secretary and would go out to Central Asia. Dissidents I would meet would talk about the assistance that Freedom House or IRI or NDI was extending, but then say, but the U.S. government isn't doing anything. I would inform them of where the groups got their money. So it's important that the U.S. government have its name on some of this. Having said that, I have reluctantly come to believe that MEPI should be placed outside of government, like the National Endowment for Democracy. It is no secret that, how can I put it, MEPI is not near and dear to the heart of the NEA Bureau. And outside government, it would have more freedom, more room for creativity, and a deniability for diplomats that is a feature of the NEA. It would also enable us to pursue the policy in a low-key way. We should also be prepared to work in a much more multilateral fashion in supporting Democrats. I mentioned before the citizens of other recently democratized nations who are helping IRI with our work. It is one of the biggest differences for me from being IRI's president in the 90s to being IRI's president today is the number of countries that are engaged in this work. And frankly, while we are navel-gazing and debating with ourselves over whether or not we should support democracy, other nations from Australia to France to Spain to Kenya to Slovakia to Taiwan to Canada have begun such effort. No democratic example, ours included, is directly transferable to other nations, but any country contemplating democratic institutions can learn from the examples of all of these other countries. Working together with Serbians or Slovaks or Indonesians or even the French, as IRI has done in the Middle East, brings home that democracy is not just an American product. Let me finish with a prediction. I think it will be difficult for any future president, Democrat or Republican, not to have democracy as part of our policy towards the region. First, promoting democracy and human rights, as I mentioned, is a 30-year-old bipartisan policy. The volume can be modulated, but no candidate has shown any signs of ending that policy. In the Middle East in particular, the arrest of dissidents, crackdowns on newspapers, and poor governance are impossible to keep quiet with the internet and 24-hour news cycles. Any president is going to be asked, as President Bush was these last 2 weeks on Burma, what more can America do? The American people are fundamentally decent, and nothing in response to that question is not a sufficient answer. Thank you.